Chris?
Hey, Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing terrific. How are you?
Fantastic.
Excellent. Well, thank you for filling in. And I should tell everybody that Bill Scher is the proud papa of a second daughter. So congratulations, Bill. And I guess he thinks that just because he's a dad again, that he gets to take time off from blogging heads. But while I object to that, I congratulate you, Bill, and to everyone, to the entire family, our best. So, CPAC just happened. Are you? Apparently, there's some sort of a post CPAC like sickness or disease that people get every year. Where I don't know if it's exhaustion or if it has something to do with the close quarters that everyone keeps. Certainly, Eric Erickson and Melissa Clouthier have written pieces about the debauchery and the lack of appropriate attire that happens at the conference. But how are you recovering?
Right. Well, the crowds are getting younger. Oh, I'm doing fine. I feel perfectly healthy. And but I think most people come away from CPAC either with a bad case of the flu or herpes. You know, it's one or the other. Or for the most unlucky souls who ended up getting lucky at CPAC, I suppose you could say they come home with both. But yeah, it was interesting this past week, the Conservative Political Action Conference. They had thousands of conservative activists. A number of young people I noticed were at the conference. I think Chris Malagisi, who ran it this year, said it's one of the most half of the attendees were under 30 years old this year. I was actually a little bit surprised that. I thought it was a little bit mundane this year. There was no huge drama that erupted at the conference. Everything seemed to go fairly smoothly, which I'm sure the organizers were perfectly happy about. But as a reporter, you know, we love the drama and everything. But I think everything was pretty mundane.
I caught on tape a fight that, well, can't really call it a fight. There was pushing. There were some Occupy DC protesters who came in into the conference. They were prohibited from going into the actual speech where Mitt Romney was actually delivering his speech into that hall. So they decided to stand in front of the TV showing Mitt Romney. And there was a little bit of a skirmish. I caught that on tape. They were escorted out.
But, I mean, Matt, that's it? I mean, we were talking.
That's pretty much it.
Thousands of protesters promised to pour into, you know, Northwest Washington, D.C., and all we get was a couple kids shouting, and then somebody blocked a TV.
Right.
I mean, is that 21st century Alinskyism? Come on, guys. Let's pick it up. I think in the words of David Weigel, meh.
Yeah. And Michelle Fields did, of course, capture video of some of the protesters outside admitting that they had been paid like $60.
Right. I mean, that's standard fare. And the thing I think I was disappointed about in the protests was, I mean, it was your cookie cutter union protest. There was nothing necessarily special about it. It was all just. I mean, some of them were paid, obviously, and obviously some of them were not. But I mean, it was
the ones on the inside. I think were true believers based on what I observed.
But it was just so standard fare. I don't know. I think they're getting soft, or if that's any indication.
Nobody got glitter bombed that I know of.
Right. Well, you can't glitter bomb Mitt Romney anymore. With Secret Service, you just don't do it. It's a stupid thing to do. You know, when federal agents can charge you with. I think the official charge for the guy that tried to glitter bomb Mitt Romney a couple weeks ago was hurling a missile at the candidate or some.
Wow.
Ridiculous language. So it was a very colorful missile. It was very pretty. Probably the prettiest missile you ever saw.
I used to play in a band, and our lead singer had a crazy girlfriend, which is almost like it's sort of like a it's like mandatory. Every band has a Yoko. And this chick she would do that. She would glitter bomb people, and like she did it to me once. And 3 weeks later, I'm standing in a 7-Eleven. And some guy's like, hey, man, you got some glitter on you.
You know, Matt, I saw you last week, and I think you still had, after all these years, a little bit of glitter on your face. Yeah.
I was like, I've had 8,000 showers since I was glitter bombed, and you're still seeing glitter.
Yeah.
But it was good to see you. That we did. The Daily Caller did have a little soiree, a little invitation-only soiree, mm-hmm. And it was good to see you. make an appearance, and a lot of people there.
There were. Now, Matt, before CPAC, you wrote a blog post that said something to the extent of, and I'll intentionally mischaracterize you, but, you know, it said, "Don't ask me to have a drink with you. I probably won't. I'm an old man. Get off my lawn. I've got a child. I'm not going to stay out and drink with you. Don't even talk to me. If you do, I'll punch you in the face." That's what you wrote verbatim, I believe.
Essentially.
Something like that. Now explain. You've been to many of these conferences. People know you from your work at Politics Daily and now at the Daily Caller. I mean, you're going soft on us here? You were a rock star in the 1990s, and now you won't even come out to a drink until 5:30 in the morning. And, you know, the old days of eating Chinese food as the sun rises. You know, what happened?
This is a young man's game. This is a Chris Moody, Alex Pappas game now. No, it's funny. I actually ran into Ben Smith in the green room up at 30 Rock, and he was literally walking around carrying a laptop, like as he would walk from room. I don't know how there are bloggers and writers who can like take their show on the road and they never miss a beat, and I really admire them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it is, whether it's age or whether it's just how I'm wired. But being at a conference like that, like, first of all, when I go to CPAC, the Wardman Park Hotel, I had to, like, leave breadcrumbs to find my way back. I mean, it was...
It's
you
true.
Need a GPS. You need I was constantly... I'm constantly lost. I never know where I'm going. And then there are constantly people coming up talking to me, mm-hmm. Some of whom I know, some of whom I don't.
And all
whom
who you
like.
Hate.
Some of them I like, some of them I don't. All of whom I pretend to know. And so it is, it's a little bit overwhelming. I think for anybody, look, we're talking about like 10,000 people or something in a place like this. And some of them, it's not that I'm a big deal, but my face is on the front page of the Daily Caller. So some people know who I am. Maybe I met them 2 or 3 years ago, but they remember me. So it makes me feel a little bit weird when people that I sort of know come up.
Now, did this happen in this conference? Did anybody mention your blog post, or did you see a reduction of people coming up to you because of it?
Actually, a lot of people mentioned it, and to my happily to my surprise, a lot of people got that it was sort of a joke, like mm-hmm. that it was done tongue in cheek, and that it was meant to be funny, and it was. And a lot of people told me that they loved it, and I had a lot of people say I feel the same exact way. So the response was actually much more positive than I thought, mm-hmm. and I'm also happy. CPAC apparently did not take umbrage to it because they actually awarded me with the Blogger of the Year award.
Yes, congratulations! So now your profile is even higher. You have even more of these scumbags trying to talk to you. I don't know how you're going to handle the fame.
It's just the hoi polloi. No, clearly I was afraid. I was really when I wrote this, I was really afraid people were going to think that I'm some sort of a self-important douchebag. And
well, you're not. I'll just say one thing. You're not self-important.
Right. Yeah. no, I mean, look, there were certainly elements, kernels of truth about how I feel in that piece. But it was mostly meant to be funny and to be fun. And happily, I think people, you know, sort of appreciated the humor mm-hmm. and weren't too worried about the other stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
Happily for that. So
well, here's to a good conference last week. Do you want to move on to a conversation about what happened late last night in Congress? They found an agreement in these negotiations between a small group of Republicans and Democrats on the payroll tax cut or the payroll tax rate, or however you'd like to call it. They're going to extend it through the rest of the year. I was just in a breakfast meeting with House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan, and a reporter asked him a pretty good question. They said, "Do you think Republicans were damaged by this entire debate because it allows the Democrats to say that, look at these Republicans opposing reducing taxes, especially on the middle class?" And he said, "Yes, right. I do. I think that the Republicans were hurt politically by this." Obviously, he articulated the message that this is not long-term, a fiscal fix. It's not a long-term tax fix. It's kind of a gimmick, if you will. I thought it was interesting that he would say that the Democrats,
yeah.
at least on the messaging round, won this one.
And I think he's right, and I think – and I give him kudos for being honest and not being a politician there. It's funny, you know, Grover Norquist has this shtick about, you know, Republicans' brand should always be for tax cuts, and the Democratic brand should always be that they want to raise taxes. And he compares it to, like, Coca-Cola versus Pepsi, and if you found a rat head in Coca-Cola, that would destroy their brand. And he says that when Republicans raise taxes, it's a rat head in their Coke. Something, he says it, it's a weird analogy, but you should Google it. You'll find it.
Right.
Google it. So I think that's what this was. Like, I totally understand short-term payroll tax cuts are not going to stimulate the economy, and they weren't paid for, but the optics of Republicans opposing a tax cut completely screws up the brand,
right?
And it was clearly a Republican loss, at least strategically.
Well, I mean, like you said, it wasn't paid for. It's into Social Security, which, you know, is a program that both sides support sustaining. And I mean, it was a tough trap. I've seen a lot of shrewd political traps here in Washington.
Yeah.
And I think that was obviously a very successful one, a pretty good one. I mean, to say that that's going to boost the economy, I think, you know, over a long period of time is you know, kind of a farce.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, I think Republicans were clearly right on the policy and clearly wrong on the politics.
I'd say, yeah, it's kind of getting an A for effort, you know, but you actually failed.
And maybe they're smart this time to, like, give in. I know that there are a lot of Tea Party freshmen who are going to be outraged that they did this. But you got to, you know, pick your hill to die on sometimes.
Right, you do. And you got to pick your battles. That's right. Although they still haven't voted on it yet. This is just a matter of, you know, kind of a super committee kind of thing where, you know, a couple leaders got together and they hashed out an agreement. But now they have to go back to the base camp and sell it to the troops.
Right.
There could be some, as you said, some very big frustrations among especially the Tea Party freshmen that are still hold and still wield quite a bit of power there because of their numbers. I don't know, Matt, do you think they'll fall in line in a way that lets it pass the House?
That is a good question. I mean, in addition to the Tea Party freshmen, obviously, you know, the Michelle Bachmans of the world. Where are they going to come down? The Stephen
right.
Kings.
But we always know where they're going to come down. But there still is like a large group of people that, you know, could hold the keys here.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be very interesting to watch. At the very minimum, the fact that Ryan and Republican leadership are saying that we should pass it, I guess. Minimizes the political damage if there is a fight. I mean, it could make Republican leadership look weak and disorganized, but it would be harder for the Democrats to make the political hay. I would think if the leadership wants to pass it.
Well, no, I don't know. Then they'll be able to say, look at these, you know, these Republicans. They can't agree on anything. They've got this crazy right-wing group within their caucus that is really the true power holders of the Republican Party. They've got a messaging strategy prepared just for this. So, I don't know. It'll be really interesting to see if they fall in line. We know who some of the holdouts are going to be, but there are the ones that go back and forth every once in a while. And so, they're hoping to vote on it by the end of this week. So we could have a good debate. On our hands just within the next few hours.
Could be very interesting.
Now,
and, again, I mean, the obvious point to be made here is that this is all done. This isn't just inside the baseball congressional wrangling. I mean, this is all done as the backdrop of the presidential race and of Barack Obama running against a do-nothing Congress. So this has large implications.
Oh, I think it absolutely does. But you got to... I think pin some of the blame on, most of the blame on the do-nothing, of course, in the Senate, which is what they were set up to do very little.
Mm-hmm.
The House is cranking out bills all day long, now that it's controlled by Republicans. The Democratic-controlled House passed literally hundreds of bills that never saw the light of day in the Democratic-controlled Senate. So, I mean, it's obviously no surprise that the Republican bills don't make it very far in the Democratic-controlled Senate. It'll be interesting. Now, you mentioned the presidential race. I am fascinated by this. I think to change gears here real quick, that Rick Santorum's rise is an amazing part of the election cycle of this whole entire narrative, this whole story. I mean, if you look at the Real Clear Politics national polling map, Santorum is bouncing up and down on the bottom the entire time. And just, you know, this week, he passed Mitt Romney in the national polls for the first time.
Yeah, people forget. I mean, he was essentially a joke for most of the presidential race. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had some good moments in the debate.
Well, I wouldn't say he's a joke. People conceived him as a joke.
Nobody really took his chances. Right. Nobody, even very smart observers, very few took him seriously as a viable candidate. I mean, I thought that he might outperform expectations and that he might parlay this into something more, that he would, you know, do well enough to, you know, run again or get his own show. But he is a real contender right now. And
yes,
he could be the nominee.
Now, but, you know, looking back, it seems a little silly to have considered, if people did, his candidacy a joke. When you look at his company, who he was with, you've got, you know, candidates like Herman Cain that had their big rise and their big fall, and other candidates that weren't doing any ground game or any actual campaigning. While this whole time people were writing off Rick Santorum, he was actually running, now it's a focused in Iowa at the time, but running a presidential campaign, writ small, but still doing it in a very serious way, in a manner that the other candidates really were not doing. You know, they were flying around doing their national stuff while he was really focusing on traditionally, I think, what mattered at that time. And I think he has been serious about his ambitions this entire cycle. But I really think it's an amazing story watching him just rise all of a sudden. It's going to be very exciting to see what happens to him. So far, I would say, and I wouldn't say this, I think, for all the presidential candidates, but win or lose, this has definitely been a net positive for Rick Santorum.
Oh, absolutely. He, no matter what happens, well, I don't say no matter what happens, but if it ended tomorrow, I think you could say that Santorum gains more. He has rehabilitated his reputation. I mean, remember, it's a guy who lost by 18 points for his reelection. He was... these scandals about his children, you know, him living in Virginia, they're going to private school, using, I guess, Pennsylvania taxpayer dollars. He was, you know, largely seen as being supportive of all the Bush-era big government spending programs, which was really very much out of style in the Tea Party days of 2010. So the fact that he is where he is today is really a testament to the campaign he ran, absolutely.
Now, Matt, what do you make of his pitch that he is the conservative alternative to Mitt Romney? Because I could see him making that case on social issues all day long. He's been consistent since the early 90s, or, you know, I'm sure he's been consistent for a lot longer than that. On these social issues, he's been a real fighter for that. On economic issues, he's not as you mentioned, not as Tea Party Republican the entire time. Do you think he can really legitimately make the case that he is the conservative alternative to Mitt Romney?
I mean, I think all of them, including Gingrich and Perry and everyone who ran, I mean, every conservative was flawed. But I think, honestly, Romney seems to be the most flawed for a variety of reasons, including Romney Care, which was the blueprint for Obamacare, which obviously is going to be it's a huge issue. And a huge problem that conservatives have with President Obama. I think you're right. Santorum is more of a populist fiscally than a lot of Republicans are. I mean, his manufacturing plan, which would favor American... I'm trying to get my light to turn on here. you can't see me doing this, but... Which would favor American manufacturing, cutting their tax rate to zero, is clearly something that a lot of free market conservatives and the Club for Growth folks don't like. They see it as picking winners and losers. So, I mean, it's not an orthodox conservative position, but I do think that clearly you're right on the cultural issues. He has been a stalwart conservative, and I think that, you know, he can essentially make the case that, you know, never mind all the big spending stuff I did. Obamacare mandates are horrible, and Romney was for them, so we can kind of muddy the waters there. So I think he can pull it off. The question is, will he have the ammo to pull it off? I mean, will Romney outspend him to such a degree that it doesn't matter who has the most convincing messaging.
Well, I think the influx of money through the super PACs has allowed these smaller candidates to certainly have a bigger role than they would have. I can't imagine that Rick Santorum would still be around with some of the money that he's had, obviously not coordinating with him, but that has propped him up a little bit. Now, I would love to know if Tim Pawlenty could speak freely. What if he had no inner monologue and he had to say it out loud? What would he be saying every time he sees a national poll that shows Rick Santorum leading Mitt Romney?
That's a great question.
I mean, it's probably a four-letter expletive shouted to the high heavens, I would imagine, but he's gritting his teeth and hoping to be VP or something, I assume.
You know. Well, look, I mean, clearly, I was one of many people who early on was saying that Pawlenty had a good shot at being the nominee, not because he was great, but because he was palatable to everybody, and he could essentially be everybody's second choice. Mm-hmm. And once it became clear that Romney might win, that he would sort of Pawlenty would be sort of a compromise candidate that conservatives turn to, but he would also be palatable to the sort of intelligentsia / establishment. And then he got out. He got out because he lost a meaningless straw poll in this summer. So he ought to be kicking himself. The problem with that is that some of the people I've talked to, some of the sources who are close to him and his campaign, have implied to me that the reason he botched that Obamacare line and that debate is that he never really thought he was going to win. He was always angling for vice president or something else.
Wow.
And that his advisors had schooled him and prepared him to go hard against Romney, and that he didn't do it. And their suggestion is that he always planned to be a bridesmaid and not the bride. So that's a great question, but I think it's a huge missed opportunity. I think if Pawlenty, whether he lost his nerve or whether it was an intentional move, I think that Pawlenty missed a huge opportunity. And look at Mike Huckabee, too. There's another guy. What if he had run?
Do you think he would have really resonated in a way he did not in 2008?
I mean, I think there's a chance. I mean, the big question mark about Huckabee is always, like, can he raise the money and build a serious organization?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that remains a question mark. But in terms of positioning himself to win Iowa, I think he could have been very well positioned stylistically, more of a populist Republican to talk about. I mean, he could go on and talk about – Mike Huckabee could actually go on The Daily Show and talk about income inequality and be persuasive. It would really very much neutralize the issue that Obama has made. Now, compare that to Mitt Romney. If Mitt Romney's the nominee, it's Gordon Gekko.
But I think Mike Huckabee made a very good quality of life argument against running for president. The dude has his own show. He's got a new house. He goes around and he speaks. People love him. He makes a lot of money. Why would you want to run for president if you're just coming into that? He's been wealthy for a long time, but I mean, this kind of life I don't think he's had. Up until this point, and I think he's just like, no, I think a guy like Mitt Romney has been the rich guy for a long time, and he's looking for something more than, he's got it all, but here's something I don't have, where Huckabee's like, no way, I want to enjoy this for a while, I'm not going to just dive right into that, and it takes a very special or even weird person to want to run for president, right?
No, I think you're totally right, and I think Huckabee probably made the best personal decision.
I think he did. Yeah. he'll probably live a little longer because
that's true. Hey, before we wrap it up, you're going on the trip. Are you going to Arizona or Michigan? Are you going to the debate? What are you going to do, and how do you see it shaping up?
Well, my flight plans are at this point still pending because we still don't know where the candidates are going to be, if they're going to be in Michigan next week or if they're going to be in Arizona or North Dakota. I mean, we really don't know. So I'm I am waiting on the Rick Santorum campaign to decide where they want to be next week, and I am at their whim. Please hurry. No.
You should pull for Scottsdale, not Minot.
Okay,
that's
good,
just my advice.
I'm going to have to pack two different kinds of clothes. You got the warm clothes and the cold. I don't know. It's going to be a little schizophrenic there for a while.
Given the choice, always take Scottsdale over Minot.
Right. I think, though, February is going to be a lot more exciting than we ever anticipated it to be. I think, you know, remember we were talking that, you know, Romney could win Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, boom, we're done. Now we're talking about a real race here, which is the reason we've got reporters going out on the trail in February.
Oh, right.
We've really got something here. And as far as a reporter, you know, my perspective, we love this. People talk a lot about, I guess, bias in the media, but to be totally honest, to maybe give away some of our secrets, I think a big bias in the media is to keep this thing going as long as possible. It's one of the only times that we've agreed with Sarah Palin, take this all the way to August, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, Newt Gingrich, it's possible that the other thing, too, is don't forget Newt with Super Tuesday. I guess it's possible Santorum wins the Midwest, the Rust Belt. Newt deprives Romney by winning the South. So could be interesting.
Yeah, you know what? After this race, seeing everything that's happened, the entire roller coaster of the whole thing, I'm not ruling anything out. I mean, you know, we get the Fred Carter surge. Who knows if he'll be the nominee after all?
He hasn't had his turn yet, so.
No, he hasn't. Or the Gary Johnson bump, you know.
Well, anyway, I guess we're about done, but I should have done this in the beginning. You've been on here before, but just so everyone knows, like, where can they read more? Where can they find you? How can they keep up with your travels?
Okay, well, my name is Chris Moody. Twitter account is just @Chris_Moody, @Chris_MOODY. And you can read us at Yahoo News. The blog specifically about the campaign is called The Ticket. But just check out Yahoo News and you'll find us.
All right. Good talking with you, Chris. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Had a good time.
You too.